This is Fresh Air. André Dubus III wants to be known as André Dubus III to distinguish him from his famous writer father, André Dubus. It doesn't seem to matter, though, because he is still confused with his father, even by some of the critics. But that hasn't prevented him from writing. He has a collection of short stories and now a new novel, Bluesman. It's a coming-of-age story set in the 1960s that explores, among other things, the rocky and yet loving relationship between a father and son, Jim and Leo Souther. André Dubus III has had more physically taxing jobs than writing. He's worked in a prison, tended bar, worked construction, which he still does, and hoped for a time to be a boxer. But somehow writing got under his skin. I asked André to read from the beginning of his new novel, Bluesman.
Haywood, Massachusetts. The Connecticut River sounded different every season. It was a gushing stone roller during the spring runoffs, a narrow and quiet flow in the summer that in the fall receded to a thin, clear wash, leaving banks of leaf-covered mud and sunken tree root until winter when the Berkshire snows came and the ice formed over the rocks and the water gurgled beneath it all as though behind a mask. On its west bank, halfway through the trees up Saunders Hill, Jim Souther picked a guitar most every night. Though he was a white man, he only sang blues songs, songs by men like Big Bill Brunsey, Mississippi John Hurt, Son House, and Champion Jack Dupre. After a supper he would cook for both himself and his 17-year-old son Leo, Jim sat in the parlor on a stool in front of the window overlooking the woods and he'd start to play. He sang all kinds of songs, some fast that Leo could hear in the kitchen while he was cleaning up or doing his homework and he would tap his feet, or else slow ones like Lonesome Road, Up, Sometimes Down, and Motherless Child. Most times they were slow like that, and Leo would sit in the parlor and listen for a while. He liked to watch his father's face. That was easy to do because most times Jim kept his eyes closed while he picked and sang. Leo liked how soft it got around the mouth under his mustache, how tender looking. And Jim was a big man, not tall and lean like Leo, but wide with thick legs, rounded shoulders, and upper arms that always needed more room than his shirt sleeves gave them.
Your father is a writer, André Dubus.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you use this novel to consciously explore your relationship with him?
Not at all. I purposely try to unconsciously write unconsciously as possible.
Gotcha.
And actually, there are very few similarities in the relationship between Leo and his father, Jim, in the novel, and the relationship between my father and myself, because my father's a very loud, talkative, gregarious guy, and this man, Jim Souther, is much more, I think, quiet and sort of introspective. And I talk more than Leo. So
okay.
When my old man and I get together, we talk. So actually, maybe I subconsciously turn it upside down, you know.
Well, you are confused with your father. I mean,
sure.
I'll be honest with you. When we got your book, we thought it was your father.
That's understandable.
And I booked the interview thinking you were your father.
I know.
And I wonder, as someone, of course, is trying to figure out their own literary life and trying to establish their own name for themselves, how you do that when everyone thinks you're somebody else, or a lot of people think you're somebody else.
Well, it's interesting. It's funny. When I published my first story when I was 22 in Playboy, which was quite an amazing thing. I didn't know how amazing it was till 117 rejections later and realized, oh, that never happens. But when I published it, I remember I just put my name, André Dubus III. They put the third, so I wouldn't be confused with my father. I grew up as André Dubus. At the time, I still wanted to be an actor. I was drawn to the stage, and so I didn't think it'd be. I thought, well, I'll publish this one story, and then I'll be an actor. But that's not what happened. I kept writing because the writing pulled me. Once that started to happen, I struggled with changing my name, and for some reason was just not able to. I began to get some real empathy for women who change their name when they get married. It's really tough to be somebody your whole life and all of a sudden be asked to be someone else, you know?
Did you try on certain names?
I tried. Oh, every time somebody would think that I was him or attribute something I had written to him and thereby sort of erase me.
Yeah.
I mean, because it goes deeper than just career. Who cares about that on a certain level? It goes deeper to a more mythological realm of the son never existed. If the three gets erased, then his dad wrote the book. So I'll tell you what, this is how I handle it now.
Go ahead.
I've been doing this about 13 years. I look at this on my best days as a spiritual opportunity, really, to put my money where my mouth is, because I really believe, and I tell this to my students in Boston, that the art is so much more important than the artist. I am so much more interested in the Joad family than I am in John Steinbeck. I'm so grateful he wrote The Grapes of Wrath, but it's the Joad family that makes him memorable, if I think about him at all.
My guest is writer Andre Dubus III. His novel, his first, is called Bluesman. We'll talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Andre Dubus III is my guest. Let me ask you, your parents divorced when you were about 11, is that right? As you look back, what kind of effect did that have on you? Or even as you remember it?
I'm 33 now, and I think I'm just starting to see that. I think sometimes we need about 20 years before we start to get a real fresh look. I think the effect it had was it did a number on my trust. And I think that's true of a lot of adult children of divorced parents.
Trust of parents?
Trust of love.
Now, you lived with your mother, is that right?
Yeah, myself and my older sister, Suzanne, my younger brother, Jeb, and younger sister, Nicole. I also have two half-sisters from my father's third marriage. But the four of us live with my mother in Haverhill, Mass., which is this real sort of, it's a very depressing textile town, mill town. Still depressing to me. I really have a hard time driving through it. My father lived across the river and where he taught at the local school and had an apartment. And so we lived in some very tough neighborhoods. And combined with a mother who was gone till 6 or 7 o'clock at night, it just added, I realized later, much later now, and through my writing I felt realize this, that I began to believe the world's a very dangerous, lousy place to be.
Well, so when did you take up boxing?
I was about 16, and I had had it. I had had it with getting beat up. For me, I took the classic road. I wanted to. I had a thing happen. A guy was hunting my brother down. He had heard that my brother had.
Is your younger brother?
My younger brother. He had heard that my younger brother had deflowered his little sister, and which
was it true?
Probably was true. But they were consenting 13-year-olds in my neighborhood. I say that half in jest, but that's how old we all were in the sexuality of that time. And I remember he beat my brother up in front of me, and it was so traumatic because I was frozen with fear. And he threatened me, and I just was frozen with fear, and he walked away, and I was the big brother who didn't defend the younger brother. And something snapped, man. I was 15 years old, and I just snapped. I actually went right into the house. I actually looked in the mirror, and with such self-loathing that I said, I don't care if my eyes get gouged out, I get stabbed 16 times, I'm never going to hate myself this much again. And since then, and it's something I still wrestle with, I have been a brawler.
Well, you've been a barroom brawler, and you've been a boxer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the boxing.
Okay,
what did that give you? It's trained controlled aggression.
Yeah, man. I learned something I didn't. I learned a big surprise. I was an athlete. I didn't know that I had a natural athletic ability. It turns out that I was a natural boxer. I went down to a local gym and I started working out, and I became almost a monk. You know, I dieted, and I would do things like run 12 miles with 10-pound bars at midnight if I'd missed a workout. I'd do 3,000 sit-ups, which takes like almost 3.5 hours to do. Really
compulsive.
You
would do 3,000 consecutive?
Continuous sit-ups. This is between the age of 16 and 20. I was just a complete madman. I went into, and I started to hang around tough athletes, boxers, and hockey players and stuff, and we go to bars on Friday night. And of course, I didn't drink. I was training for my first big fight, where I took on a bully, and I actually took on a guy because I also discovered something in the gym. I had a knockout punch. This is all surprised me. It's like this hidden gift. And I remember this one guy. I won't give his name. We're on the radio, but I was afraid of him all through high school. He was a cousin to one of the big biker gangs who had ties to Hell's Angels, who had ties to the mob in Worcester. I was, you didn't mess with him. He's one of these guys everyone hated because not only was he tough and tall and 6 feet and deep voice, but he also, all the women loved him. He had blonde hair and blue eyes and looked like Paul Newman, but I hated him. I was always afraid of him. Well, that night in the bar, he pushed my brother down the stairs. Just as it came
for
around.
For no obvious reason.
Well, it came about that way. And I remember it was the first time I dealt with my adrenaline in a different way. I've learned something about adrenaline. We tend to think it's fear. And see, I would feel all this adrenaline, and I think, well, I'm very afraid. Well, it must be a good reason I'm afraid. I'm very afraid because I'm weak and small. I'm going to get killed.
That's the
rationalization.
Yeah.
Right. So instead, I let my body take over and said, no. I feel this in the gym, and I knocked the crap out of those guys in the ring, so I'm going to do it now. Of course, I wasn't conscious. I was just flowing with it. Anyway, I ended up knocking the guy's teeth out, and then I kept swinging, but the bouncer was in there, and then a huge bar brawl broke out. The six buddies I was with went after the bouncer, and the bar closed down for 6 months. It was a bizarre scene, but it started what turned out to be a string of strange things for me. I would go to bar rooms, and I would look for trouble. Of course, thank God, this is before handguns was in everyone's pocket. This is like 78, 79. But more times than not, I would jump in on husband-wife disputes, which was always stupid.
Well, how typical do you think you were then? I mean, if we read or see about barroom brawls, were they people like you looking to prove something?
Yeah, I don't think it's consciously, though. I think most guys, worked in the factory, worked on the job, and they had no expressive outlet, and they showed up to get anesthetized by beer and shots and, have a release that way. I actually heard a local tough guy once. I was living over a shoe store, and I was just starting to write. This early 80s. And interestingly enough, as soon as I started to write, a whole bunch of rage just went down, just went right down. I found an expressive outlet. There was a bar room right underneath where I lived, and a fight broke out in the street. And I knew one of the guys in the fight, and he was pummeling a very big guy, and he really hurt him. And, of course, in these fights, they're more like Scorsese fights. I mean, once a guy's down, you start kicking him in the head until he's almost dead. And the guy finished that, and he started walking up the street shirtless with his buddy and saying, yeah, I really felt like being in a fight. I've been wanting to be in a fight all week. I really needed to just, be in a fight tonight. And I knew that he was consciously looking for a way to express himself. And for the first time it occurred to me up in that room, this guy just needed to express himself.
Hmm. Do you get a rush now talking about this stuff?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, and it's something I need to write about more in depth.
Let me get back to your father, because I'm watching the clock here.
Sure.
And your father was disabled pretty severely by a car accident some time ago. Let me read just a section of an essay that he wrote, and this is about you. And you say to him, do you want me to carry you down? It's a family get-together, and he's, I guess, up on a
deck.
On a deck somewhere, and you all are out in the grass, and
right.
And you ask him if you can carry him down. And he writes, I do not know. I have not been on the lawn since Cadence was 4 and Madeline was in her mother's womb. I want to be down there with my family. I do not like being carried. Either I feel more frangible now, or I know how frangible we all are. My injury has led me to people with injuries I never considered when I was whole. I am afraid of falling, of being paralyzed. Being carried frightens me in ways I cannot name. Perhaps the absolute surrender to another human being dramatizes for me the dangers I can no longer ward off or evade. I know Andre will not fall or drop me, so I feel all of this. Caden says, yeah, Dad, please. And I was reading that. I was thinking about as a son, to hear, the utter vulnerability, I guess, of one's own parent. And also, what's it like to carry your dad? You do carry him down, and I'm sure you've carried him other times too. But what does it feel like to carry your father?
Oh, that's a good question, boy. Maybe I can start by answering it in a way to answer it by talking about carrying my son. I've only been a father for almost 5 months, and it's just the amount of love is. I'm just amazed at the degree of love you feel. I mean, I would gladly take a bullet for my son in an instant. And I never understood when parents talk that way, but now I do. And so when I carry my father, I feel, again, gratitude that I'm strong and fit enough to carry him. And I feel, underneath all that is sadness at the loss, but also the sort of dawning acceptance of what is. And
I'm struck, though, with the comparison between holding a 4.5-month-old child who, of course, fits very neatly into one's arms as if you're sort of made to carry a small baby, and the idea of what it is to carry a man, as he says, I'm 40 pounds heavier than you are, and just how to sort of gather them up and make sure that you're going to be steady and okay and that you're not going to drop them. He believes that you're not, but just the difficulty of carrying a parent.
Early in his accident, I took care of his bedpan, and he's written about that, so it's nothing private for people to know about. That was even more intimate, of course, when you wipe someone else. And I thought at first you have to wade through this homoerotic stuff. I mean,
even with your father,
even with one's father, it's still touching another man's naked butt. And we in this culture, we're very homophobic and got to work through all that crap. And I guess the intimacy is what it's all about. And so when I carry my father, I am having faith that I'm strong enough to do it. When I hold my 5-month-old son, I'm having faith that I'm going to be a good dad. And I'll tell you one thing I wrestle with is being a provider. I mean, when you're in the arts and you work carpentry jobs as they come and do part-time teaching, the money's always kind of scarce and fly by night. And yeah, so the heart of that for me is they're both very intimate. And I think they're intimate because I'm trying to face my truth in relation to each of them, the son, the father. And that is, well, the truth is, I'm glad to be his son, and I'm joyous to be his son, and I'm joyous to be my son's father.
Andre Dubus III is a writer. His novel is called Blues Man. This is Fresh Air.